this thing flow with some of you who are still having some trouble grasping what I've been trying to explain about Ezra chapter 4. Because sometimes looking at it in this fashion is helpful. Get on the screen. There we are. Is that looking at it in this fashion, what we have is Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. This is in chronological order. And then beginning with, verse 6, we begin to get into a digression from the main topic, which is, of course, the problem with building the temple. Actually, it begins to start to digress here even in verse 5, that here it's talking about the problems in getting the temple built, and here it's talking about problems with their neighbors and accusations against them. That becomes now the new theme. It's no longer just the building of the temple as a theme. It is now, in verse 5, both, of course, the problem of building the temple and the sub-theme of accusations raised by their neighbors. And then the author goes off on this sub-theme of accusations raised against them by their neighbors to talk about a particular accusation that was raised after the complete reign of Darius, in which the temple was built, in the reign of the succeeding king Ahasuerus, who was generally regarded as Xerxes. And then, even in a later reign, a real dilly of an accusation, and this is such an important accusation that the author is presenting the entire complaint. While he leaves it anonymous here, and he doesn't bother to detail the charges here, this was such an important complaint that he is giving it in full. And of course, this complaint continues beyond verse 15. There's no way I can get this all in one. And the complaint comes to an end with the end result of that complaint, in verse 23, that when King Artaxerxes had replied, then these people came up to Jerusalem and, armed with the authority of this letter from the Persian king, they made them cease by force and power in what they were doing. And then, after having exhausted this sub-theme at this point, the author then returns to the main theme, which was the building of the temple, and gets back to it in verse 24. And so, in chronological order, really, verse 5 should be followed by verse 24 if we are to proceed with just the story of the temple. And then, of course, the whole of chapter 5 and the whole of chapter 6 is dealing with the temple. Now, I think we mentioned before that when you look at this letter of complaint, it has nothing to do with the building of the temple. That the letter of complaint has nothing whatsoever to do with the building of the temple. And that if we look at the... Oh, that would be more difficult for you, yes. You can't read it upside down and backwards both. One maybe, but not both. That's asking too much, especially at 8 o'clock in the morning. Right? Okay, look at the charge. It says, "Be it known to the king that the Jews which came up from you to us..." Now, we will have reason for coming back to that particular phrase later to see if we can milk more understanding from this phrase, "the Jews which came up from you to us," are come to Jerusalem and are what? Building the rebellious and bad city. Doesn't talk about the temple. "And have finished the walls thereof and joined the foundations. Be it known to the king that if this city be builded and the walls be finished, then they will not pay toll, tribute, and custom, and the revenue of the kings will suffer loss." In other words, once they get their security behind a wall, they will become rebellious and will not pay you tribute. "Now, because we have maintenance from the king's palace..." In other words, since we're on the payroll, That's the way we would translate it today. It is not meet for us to see the king's dishonor. Anyway, we don't like these people anyway, but that's parenthetical, not mentioned. Therefore, we have sent and certified to the king that a search be made in the records of your fathers, and shall find and know that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and they have moved sedition within the same of old time, for which cause the city had been destroyed. In other words, check this city out, and you'll find out what kind of temperament these people have. And you'll see that we are justifiably concerned in letting this city have a wall that they can hide behind. And so when we get down to Artaxerxes' reply, notice again the final point in verse 16, we certify that if the city be builded and the walls finished, by me, this means you shall have no portion on this side of the river. Now you know what this side of the river means. It's talking about Avarnachar, the name of the whole western satrapy. You see, he's saying this whole western satrapy will be lost to your empire if you let this city be built. Now that's rather an extreme claim, wouldn't you think? Not just the city will be rebellious, or Judea, this minor province, will be rebellious, but this whole satrapy called Avarnachar will be lost to you. Now, were they indulging in just rhetoric and exaggeration for effect? Well, suspend judgment for that for now, because at a later time we will get into that particular phrase and see what lies behind it by examining the history of this period in which we would put this letter. And we will see that it relates to certain events going on at that time. Yes? Well, it means that it's practically finished and they're ready to join it all together and set up the final gates. In other words, it's almost complete, that unless you intervene right away, you know, this thing is going to be a fait accompli. Yeah. So the king sends an answer and he says, I commanded, search has been made, it is found, the city of old time has made insurrection against kings, and rebellion and sedition have been made therein. And indeed there were mighty kings also over Jerusalem, which ruled over all the countries beyond the river, talking about David and Solomon particularly, and Uzziah and Jeroboam the second among them. Give you now commandment to cause these men to cease, that the city be not builded. See, it's talking about the city's security. Until another commandment shall be given from me. You see, note that expression, the laws and the Medes and the Persians? What was it about the law of the Medes and the Persians? Mr. Uda? Once it is pronounced, it cannot be changed. We know that from the book of Daniel, that when Darius the Mede was tricked into passing this decree that nobody could invoke any god except himself for 30 days on penalty of being thrown to the lions, he realized it had just been a stratagem to get at Daniel too late. There was nothing he could do to save Daniel. He had to put him in the den and say, I hope your God is powerful enough to take care of you. And you know how it says, early the next morning, he could hardly wait. He didn't sleep all night. He rushed to the den to see if Daniel was still alive. You know. It's for this reason also that in the book of Esther, that once Ahasuerus had given command that people had liberty to attack the Jews, he couldn't cancel the command. So he had to issue one that said the Jews had a right to arm themselves and fight anybody that would attack them. Because that was the only way he could counteract it, because once delivered, the command could not be reversed. That each of those two commands had been absolute commands. That's why this particular king, thinking clearly, said, I might have reason to change my mind in the future, so I leave myself an escape hatch by giving command that it not be builded. I don't stop at that point until another commandment shall be given by me. So it's only a suspension, you see. It's not an absolute perpetual prohibition. That's why the wording is the way it is. And then, of course, once they were armed with the king's letter, they went up and made them stop their building of the walls and the city. Okay, I hope this clarifies this a little bit. Does anybody else have any comments or questions that you want to ask on this point? No? Okay. We will dispense with that. And now we will turn our attention to the subject matter that we want to address specifically today, which is to attempt a reconstruction of, and I can't get this all, the whole thing on here, and don't worry about your necessity to start scribbling crazily to get all this down. I have a copy for all of you. And you can scribble additional notes on this particular one. There are actually two of these charts. The other chart we will get to later in a few more lectures. So don't let the other chart worry you right now. I'll wait a few minutes so that we have time for this chart to circulate and reach all of you. Dealing with events in Judea. And then above the line, you have these dotted lines that go up from the dates. Well, they don't have anything written there, but we will add some comments to those dotted lines above the line so that you will be able to have a complete picture. Because otherwise, if we just read the book of Ezra, we are well informed about events in Judea, but we lack all information about what was going on in the wider world. And that's what's necessary to understand if we're to understand fully the events going on in Judea. You can't just study the history of Judea as if it existed in a total vacuum. You have to put it in its proper context. Okay, let's begin on the upper left where you have the dotted line going up from 539, and you could put down that the army of Cyrus conquers Babylon. That's the event, of course, that took place in 539 BC. The army of Cyrus conquers Babylon. Then we are told in Ezra chapter 1 that it was in his first year that Cyrus issued his famous decree, and we would presume therefore also that this is the dating of the Cyrus cylinder. So what we can do is next to 538 we can put the decree of the return. And we can put in parentheses under that, parallel the Cyrus cylinder. What we mean by that, of course, is the decree that I was speaking about earlier on, which was addressed to the people of Babylon in the name of the god Marduk, which is very much a similar type of decree. Then we see that as a result of that decree, as we see below the line, the Jews were allowed to return and to rebuild the temple. And when they got there, we have the first return under Sheshbazzar, and the foundation is laid for the temple. Where exactly we put the return of Zerubbabel, it's not certain. We're not given any specific information in Scripture. We've already talked about the fact that Zerubbabel may have been present when Sheshbazzar actually laid the foundation. Or it might have been renewed later when Zerubbabel returned. This is a small point. It's not essential. But we know for sure that Zerubbabel could not have returned any earlier than 538, because that's when the decree was issued, right? We know he could not have returned any later than 530. How do we know that? You'll notice above the line it says 530 is the date of the death of Cyrus. Why should that be important in putting a lower limit as to when Zerubbabel could have returned? You'll notice I have here under 5:30, I have Ezra 4, 1 to 5. Why don't you cast your eyes over those scriptures and see if therein there lies a clue. Otherwise, I have added something to the chart which is redundant. Not redundant, which is unnecessary. Redundancies are sometimes unnecessary, sometimes not. Some things are unnecessary without being redundant. Hence my correction. Wes? Okay, but that could have been by decree before he actually arrived and became the leader. But what we're talking about is why he had to have arrived before the death of Cyrus. What is there? Lynn? Yeah, that as a result of Zerubbabel's harsh words to the Samaritans, they troubled them in building and hired counselors against them all the days of Cyrus. You see, so he had to have been there before Cyrus died. Otherwise, you couldn't have had that comment made. So somewhere between 538 and 530, he arrived. I tend to lean more towards the earlier date rather than the latter, but that's just speculation on my part. And I can't prove it one whit, but somewhere in there he certainly had to arrive. Now, we find that because of all this trouble from the surrounding peoples, they did not really get down to doing it until, as it says in verse 24 of Ezra chapter 4, the second year of King Darius. Now, we know that the second year of King Darius was 520. So above the line where you have that dotted line going up from 520, I'll talk about that line first. You should put in, you've got an asterisk here in 520 and a dotted line going up. You should put second year of Darius, or Darius as some people like to call him, the first. Depends, I think, if you have an English training or an American training. Yes. How do we know that 520 BC was the second year of Darius? Okay, because in 522 something happened, which tells us that was the second year of Darius. Okay, in 522... we have the death of Cambyses. Some will say Cambyses, who was Persian, son of Cyrus and the Persian emperor after him. And we have the outbreak of civil war. Between Pseudo-Smerdis and Darius the First. So Darius the First dated his reign from beginning with the death of Cambyses, but it takes a while before he actually gets things tied down. Now, that I gave away the store. Shouldn't have said that. Oh, boy. Let's turn to, that happens when your brain isn't screwed on straight. That's a mixed metaphor. I better not say anything else. Let me borrow your Bible since you have a convenient one located near you. Let's turn for a minute now to the book of Haggai and take a look at how that book opens. I know it's not one of the books you routinely read. Hopefully you can find it. Heard of those towns that if you blink while you go through them, you've passed it.
Well, Haggai is a book like that. If you turn too many of these thin pages, you've passed it. Or two stick together, you've passed it.
It says in the book of Haggai, verse 1 of chapter 1, that in the second year of Darius, now what year is that? As again, we can establish it by history, secular history, it's 520 BC. It's one of the few books of the Bible we can give an absolute date to, you see, because of our sources from outside the Bible. In the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Eternal by Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judea, and to Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest. Notice this time he is called Joshua. In the book of Ezra, he's called Yeshua. And it's the same thing. But here he's just giving his Hebrew name rather than his Aramaic name. Thus says the Eternal of hosts, the people say the time is not come, the time that the Eternal's house should be built. And then goes in, there's a complaint that people have left off what they should have been doing, which was building the house of God, and have contented themselves with building their own houses and trying to do their own business and build fortunes for themselves. And so God says, consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you don't have enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earns wages to put it in a bag of holes. Now, shouldn't this tell you something? Your conspicuous lack of success in your private ventures should have alerted you to the fact that there's something wrong because I'm not blessing you. But you haven't even stopped to think about it. And of course, the reason God isn't blessing them is because they haven't built the house. Then the prophecies of Haggai, which of course, remember that the word prophecy means in its major sense, inspired preaching. You see, exhortative preaching, gets quite strong in the last the second chapter, towards the end of it. In verse 20, the word of the Eternal came to Haggai in the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judea, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them. That doesn't just mean any chariots. I have to understand the reference. It's talking about the king's chariot and the chariots of the highest officials around the king. In other words, not only would the king be overthrown, but also all of his high officials, you see. And the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. In that day, says the Eternal of hosts, will I take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, says the Eternal, and will make you as a signet, for I have chosen you, says the Eternal of hosts. Now, this is a very strong prophecy. What was the end result? Well, let's wait a minute and consider Zechariah, who also prophesied in the same period. Notice Zechariah, his prophecy comes not in the sixth month, but in the eighth month of the second year of Darius. We have a prophecy by Zechariah. And it's much on the same theme, you know, that they better get with what God wants done, which is specifically building the temple. Now, how do we find Zerubbabel pictured here? In chapter 3, verse 8, this is addressed to Joshua the high priest. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, you and your fellows that sit before you, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch. Behold the stone that I have laid before Joshua. Upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, says the Eternal of hosts, and remove the iniquity of the land in one day. In that day, says the Eternal of hosts, shall you call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree? Then, of course, we come down into chapter 4, another prophecy to Zerubbabel, beginning in verse 6. This is the word of the Eternal to Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Eternal of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, grace, grace, unto it. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of his house. His hands shall also finish it, and you shall know that the Eternal of hosts has sent me on to you. You can turn over to chapter 6, which I think is sort of the most dramatic of all these prophecies. Beginning in verse 12, thus says the Eternal of hosts, behold the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place and shall build the temple of the Eternal. Even he shall build the temple of the Eternal and shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule upon his throne. He shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. And the crown shall be to Helam and Tobiah and to Jedidiah and Han the son of Zephaniah for a memorial in the temple of the Lord. Okay, what happened once the people heard these very exhortative prophecies? What effect did this have upon the people's behavior? Well, we find the answer if we go back to Ezra chapter 5. In Ezra chapter 5, we open that chapter by reading, then the prophets Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. It doesn't detail what they said. We can read what they said in their own books, as we have just done. What effect did those prophesyings have? Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Uzzadok, and they began to really build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. They really got with it with great zeal, to such a point that when Tatnai, who was the satrap, he was the one in charge of the whole district, of which Judah was just one small part. Remember, Zerubbabel was the governor of Judah, but Judah is just one of several provinces in this satrapy called Avarnachar. Tatnai, governor of Avarnachar, as it should have remained untranslated rather than being mentioned as this side of the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions, and said, who has commanded you to build this house? You know, where did you get the authority to do this? How dare you? Then we said unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? You know, let's get it down in writing for the report. You know, who's responsible for doing this unauthorized building? But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease. They refused to obey that satrap and his officials and cease. They continued to build. And they said, in essence, you check with the king about this. We're not going to stop even while you check. We're going to keep going. And you can check up on it on your own. And so Tatnai sent a letter to Darius, saying, as we see in verse 8, be it known to the king that we went into the province of Judea, to the house of the great God, which is builded with great stones, and timber is laid in the walls. The work goes fast on and prospers in their hand. And we said, who commanded you to build this? We got their names. And they said, we're servants of the God of heaven and of earth. We build this house that was built of these many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and set up. And then it recites, of course, their history and gives their reasoning that it was Cyrus who gave them permission. And then, of course, chapter 6 tells us Darius checked and found that that was indeed the case. And so he sends a command back to Tatnai, you know, don't interfere. This is official. they are indeed within their rights. They are fully certified to keep doing what they're doing. We find a whole new attitude in the minds of not only the leaders, but also the people generally. And you know, I wonder how often, if you've read this before, especially chapter 5, verse 1 and then verse 2, have you stopped to think about what a unique thing you have just read? Ezra chapter 5, verse 1, says these two men got up and prophesied. How often in the past did that happen? How often did Isaiah get up, or Jeremiah, and say, "Get with it"? And what was the response? Ho-hum. We don't need you to tell us what to do. We're doing all right. Who are you to set yourself up to tell us, you know, this is what we have to do? That was the more typical response. Here we have something very unusual. They get up and prophesy, and immediately everybody gets into the mainstream. They immediately heed this prophecy. Why? Well, I think in part because God wanted the response to take place, but I think that there was an awful lot of walking by sight. It wasn't so much walking by faith on the part of the people. Consider now those prophecies I've asked you to examine and which we've read about Zerubbabel. What impression do they make upon you? What flavor do they have? If you read those prophecies in Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, how would you label them? Connie? You have no idea. What flavor do they have? What time period would you put them as referring to? Mrs. Reagan? Okay. Okay. But how do you, would they have interpreted this term, the branch? And my servant, and he shall sit upon his throne, and the glory shall be upon him. What would they have associated those words with? Don? Yeah. They'll use the Greek form, they would have used the Hebrew. Mashiach. Messiah. Zerubbabel seems to be described very heavily in messianic terms. And even the use of the imagery, sitting, what you could call every man his neighbor, sitting under his vine and fig tree, when does that happen? Yeah. You see, you can see that they would have seized on those prophecies and said, "Oh! Those prophecies of the millennial peace," well, they wouldn't have used the word millennial because we would use it. But the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel that talked about after our return from captivity, we would have this fantastic abundance and we would have the exaltation of Israel as a nation and all the other nations would flow onto it for instruction in the ways of God. We were disappointed before because it didn't happen as soon as we got back. Well, we just sort of got disappointed a little too early. See, here's a prophecy telling us it's right now. We've got to get busy. You see, we've got to do this. Now, what would have impressed them that these prophecies were meant to be taken in that way? Well, if we look again for a moment at Haggai chapter 2, verse 20. Actually, beginning in verse 21. "Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms." Why is it in plural? Does somebody have a variant translation? Slight subtle difference, or is it always the same? Yes, Mike? Yeah, okay. I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, which of course is what's going to inaugurate the reign of God on earth and the exaltation of Israel, and this business of getting rid of those who ride in the chariots. But you see, what was going on right at the time that this prophecy was pronounced? There was civil war in the empire between Smyrnus and Darius, and that sparked the rebellion of many provinces against Persian rule. They sensed the disorder at the top and saw an opportunity to rebel and become independent, and it looked like the Persian empire was about to fall. But if you had been living in that day, you would have seen the Persian Empire tottering back and forth, seemingly about to fall. And so in just that time period, when people are witnessing great turmoil within the empire, it seems like it's ready to collapse any moment, here comes a prophet and says, God says, I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth, and the thrones of kingdoms are going to fall. They're going to overthrow the kings and other lordly rulers. Of course they'd say, this must be our day. It's going on already. Isn't God gracious to us? Before it was all done and finished and we were left without any reward because we weren't actively involved at the time it actually happened, he's let us be warned, and so we can still get active and have some kind of reward as a result. And so you can understand the great zeal that they put into getting the temple built, because they applied these prophecies for their own day. But did God shake all the thrones of kingdoms and overthrow the strength of the heathen in their day? No. By 519 BC, you might want to put an addendum in there, the Persian Empire stabilized under the rule of Darius I. And once it has stabilized, Darius removed a source of potential disloyalty which had come out in this period of civil war. He removed from their positions as governors every governor of the empire who was of the royal blood of the people he was ruling. Every single one of them was removed. All governors of royal blood were removed. I don't mean Persian royal blood. In other words, if in Phoenicia you had a Phoenician ruling his people, and he was of the royal house of Phoenicia, he would have been removed. If in Bactria you had a Bactrian prince ruling over his people as a governor of the province, he would have been removed, because he felt this was too dangerous to allow somebody of such high status to be the governor. It would be too much of a tendency for him to seize upon any moment of weakness to rebel and lead his people into independence. So all of them were removed. Now, why is that important? That in 519, according to secular sources, this action took place. Jeff? Yes. He was a prince of the house of David, and therefore he went too. The Bible is silent about what happens to Zerubbabel. His death is not mentioned, which is unusual. Usually, you know, the great leaders God used, you know, you have some reference to their death. There's nothing said about Zerubbabel from this point on. We don't know when he died, how he died, what happened. What we do know from outside sources is he ceased to be governor and therefore the leader of Judea in 519. When was the temple finished? Despite that setback, they kept building. 515. See? 4 years later. Now, some have said, well, wait a minute, this prophecy said his hands have laid the foundation. His hands shall also finish it. Zerubbabel could not possibly have been in charge when that temple was finished. It's not possible. I'll leave you with that conundrum, and we'll pick up at that point next time. You can mull that over and think about it.